Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's just before Lag BaOmer here. It's Wednesday. And this week looks like we have an embarras mal derish, a lot of big yard sites. And do what I'll talk about today, or it's tomorrow, is the Rama, the famous author of the Shulchan Aruch, back in the 1500s. He's a very, very interesting figure. And the Rama also, you can talk for 12 hours and still have plenty of room. I'm serious about this. I have a personal stake in Rama because I am related to his sister, it turns out. He had a sister named Miriam Bela, and she must have been a very chashuv individual. And the only reason I say that is because there's a famous book from the Chidah called Hashem HaGadolim, and very famous back in the 18th century. And he lists over there, it's a very famous encyclopedia of famous authors and famous farm. I mean, the Rishon HaMachronim, you know, all the big, it's a classic safer for looking up who's who. And it's all men. I mean, who wrote a sefer? Who were the big rabbi? There's a male. And there's one exception. There's one woman in the whole book. And that's Miriam Bela, the sister of Ma. I have no idea why. Nobody else has any idea why. All these guys who are writing commentaries on the Chidah are trying to figure out who is she and whatever. And obviously, she was a big deal once upon a time. The Rama himself, Moshe Isserles, and therefore his sister, multi-millionaire family. Here you have a situation which is, I regard as very, very interesting. The Rama usually classically is regarded as a boring biography. Not too many dramatic events happen in his life, although there are some. But it really is not. It's a very, very unusual type. Here's somebody that was born with a silver spoon in his mouth to great wealth and luxury, was a child genius, and used all of his resources to make himself the biggest gadol. You know, say, notice he made full positive use of the resources. Some people, you give them $1 million, they'll blow it. It's a waste on them. That's probably most people. And some people, if they had $1 million, they would use it in the right way, l'toru l'teuda, you know. And the Rama lived in the early 1500s in Poland, the golden age of Poland. He is the golden age of Poland. And that's when the Jews had it good. And he's from Krakow, which was the capital city of Poland at that time, one of the oldest cities, the oldest universities. In his time, Krakow was really a cosmopolitan center of international culture and science, by the standards of the 16th century, of course. And his father was loaded, and a big Talmud Chacham, Yisrael Isser, classic old-school Ashkenazi millionaire Poland style, meaning, Listen to what I'm about to tell you. He was so rich that he said, I guess, I'm not going to send my son to college. Why would I do that? I'll hire from the best tutors to make him the best lamdan, and he'll grow up to be a big gadol. And that's exactly what happened. So from the time he was young, he came from a rich family. The father could afford to hire the best rebbes, you know, one-on-one, and the best people to teach him lamdas and halacha and all that kind of business, because money's no object. And therefore, he got an elite education, and he made full advantage of it because he was happened to be the type of kid that had this genius brain. Let's put it this way. He got smicha when he was 13. Of course, I'm sure having the family money didn't hurt, but he's a bar hachi. And he was already a rov of Abezin in Krakow, which is the capital city. I think by the time he was 20 years old. So even though there's obviously some protection involved over there, but you get still, once again, got to be a bar hachi. And you and I know from our vantage point today, it wasn't just a nepotism. Look, he turned out to be one of the greatest gadolim, arguably the greatest. So it's just a very interesting profile that I just described. Somebody who did all the right things and made all the right moves and was a nice guy. Now, he didn't come across as arrogant if you ever read his stuff. He doesn't come across as taking advantage of his situation. You know, at someone else's expense. The opposite is always very thoughtful, very respectful of others. It's very interesting Not many people are eyeing in the Ramah, especially his many, many different writings. But if you do, you see, like I said before, he has very nice midos, really an aristocratic temperament in the best sense of the word, not the haughty and arrogant sense of the word. That's why it's just interesting to me, being related to his sister, you know, what was that all about? Mm-hmm. Because I did a little bit of research on her, because after all, it's an ancestor, and it's hard to find stuff. But she was a Gabbai Tzedakah. Isn't that funny? Gabbai Tzedakah. Who the heck knows what even that means back in the 1600s? 1500s. This is a little digression here. Does a Gabbai Tzedakah mean that she was in charge of one of the individuals in charge of the total Tzedakah fund of the city or Poland? That's a powerful position indeed, especially for a woman. So that means that, you know, let's put it this way. It wasn't that she was a woman, it's that she's a millionaire, you know? That's where she had her pull. Alternatively, Gabbai Tzedakah could mean, I don't know, Gabbai Tzedakah means she was in charge of giving the money out to the women, because that's more of a tzedakah way, correct? You know, you have men who need tzedakah and things like that, of course, and you have females. And it's not necessarily appropriate for a man to be involved with giving stuff out to females and knowing their private situations, which tzedakah. Look, I'm in the rabbi business, you know, but you have to know all these private information involving tzedakah situations. Not everybody you think needs tzedakah does, and vice versa. And so maybe in those days they had it that if you're a woman, you go to her, you know what I'm saying? So she's the Gabbai Tzedakah over there. All we know is she was a big, big deal, Miriam Bela. And she had a dramatic death. She died on her anniversary of her wedding. The day her daughter... Let's put it this way. She died just before her daughter walked down the chuppah. I mean, it's like a movie, right? And it's a Friday. We'll see in a minute. I'll get back to this later. The weddings used to be on Fridays, preferably. And, oh my goodness, you could just imagine what a scene that was. But to get back to the Ramah, or Moshe is a listener, Moshe Ben Yisrael listener. Here's somebody, as I said before, who had all these golden opportunities, who obviously was a genius. Whose father, because he was a very wealthy merchant, that's how he made money in those days, traveled in the highest circles. Krakow was the capital city of Poland. Jews were in all kind of interesting situations in the court of the king of Poland. They weren't in the government, but the Jews were the doctors, the physicians, especially Sephardim. And so a lot of Sephardim ran away from Spain and made their way to Poland. Why not? That, like, people ran away from Hitler and came to America. And you had some famous Spanish Sephardim doctors who were Talmidei Chacham, and some were Mekubalim, and all this kind of stuff. And here you have the young son of the rich guy having to do with them. It's not a shtetl, I'm trying to tell you. People who don't know think Krakow, Poland is all a shtetl. It's not a shtetl. There were rabbanim in shtetls. He's like a rabbi, you might say, quote unquote, in New York City, you know, a cosmopolitan place. Dramor learned for a couple years in Lublin by Shalom Shachna, who is also one of these extremely powerful and rich kings. I'm sorry, rabbis, the king of Poland made Shalom Shachna. He was like a big Rosh Yeshiva, a very big Rosh Yeshiva, and he was Mr. Lumdus of the old style Lumdus, Mr. Pilpul. He was the big Talmud of Rabbi Yaakov Pollock. And Shalom Shachna was empowered by the king of Poland that he could issue death penalty on any Jew that didn't listen to the Bezin. I mean, that's how influential the Jews were once upon a time. It was a wild and crazy period. But aside from learning by Shalom Shachna for a couple of years, and some say he married his daughter, it's not clear. He spent the rest of his life in Krakow. It reminds you a little bit about Rashi, who lived all in one place, except for a few years when he learned elsewhere. And the Ramah did not live a long life. There's always many legends that Jewish... You know, tradition, especially the Gedolim, are full of half-truths and lies and baloney legends. Yeah, they say he lived 33 years, and he died a log bomber, and this, you know, nobody knows. To be accurate about it, as far as we know, the Ramah was born around 1525, something like that, and he died in 1572. So what does that mean? He was 47, 48, when that's a young, but it's not like 33. And nobody knows exactly how and why he died, although... There are some interesting speculations, which I'll tell you about shortly, I plan to. Now, in the case of the Ramah, as I said before, here's somebody who became the head of a very prestigious court. I think he's the one who set up the basin over there. And because he was a zillionaire by Yerusha, he always had a big yeshiva that he never had to have a mashulach. You understand? You had this in Poland in those days. He had his own private yeshiva. You can't fire him, so to speak. He's the boss. And great students flocked to him. And so he had a grand old time. And the Jews in Krakow lived, as they say, kind of a gilded ghetto. And they lived in an area called Kazimierz, which is often quoted in the Sfarim. And this must have been such a proud Jewish community and independent that they regarded the Jewish quarter, the Jewish, I don't want to use the word ghetto, but, you know, because it wasn't a place they had to live, but it's a place they wanted to live. And the Gittin, you know, the Gittin were signed in Kazimierz, which is kind of interesting because usually when Gittin, you're supposed to write in the city, Krakow, but, you know, they did over there, all of which is taken by the historians, Balaban and the others, to show you that the Jewish community there was well off, self-assured, in a good situation. And those were the good years, the particularly good years of the Kingdom of Poland. Just very interesting. He lived at the right time, shall we say, and the right place. But it's also true that there were a lot of cosmopolitan knowledge flowing through Krakow. And so the Rama is just very interesting in many ways. Here's one of them. On the one hand, he's Mr. Learning. So obviously he was a great Gaon, obviously. Second of all, he had a natural interest in halacha. Of course, if you're the head of the Beis Din, while you're also giving the yeshiva, that's the old school type of Rosh Yeshiva. Then, of course, you have your head every day with halacha questions, correct? In other words, the shiurim you give aren't simply, you know, like brisk or lumdus or something like that. They're always going to be that you have in mind at the back of your head or even farther to the front. I have this big shaila that the Beis Din is dealing with and that big shaila the Beis Din is dealing with. So therefore, he's going to be very halacha lemaisa oriented. We know he gave a lot of shiurim in Tur and in the Mordechai, which used to be the classic Ashkenazi halacha book. And of course, in Shas and Poskim and that sort of thing, Gemara Shitosus and Rishonim. But very heavy emphasis on halacha. And that's why the Rama will become associated not with writing books on lumdus, but rather writing with books on halacha lemaisa. In fact, obviously, you know, he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, right? The Ashkenazi part. So this is the guy that, it's not a question of, you know, did he follow the Shulchan Aruch? He wrote the Shulchan Aruch. Now, in this context, you have somebody who spent all of his life, not so long he lived, he didn't live to be 50 years old, teaching a lot of halacha classes, a lot of gemara. Because when I say halacha, I'm talking about in the deep way, which is every halacha, you go to the sugya, and you work your way up from the gemara, to the Achroni Achronim of his time. He was a classic Ashkenazi Jew, but he's living in Poland. For those of you who don't know, which is probably most of you, the Ashkenazi Jews originally started in France, ended up in Germany, and in Germany, they moved all over Germany, and eventually the Minhagim, the Minhag Ashkenaz, kind of split into two. It's what they call the Western Ashkenaz custom and the Eastern Ashkenaz custom. So the Western Ashkenaz system is what we would call today the Yekis, the Minhag of the Rhineland, Frankfurt, the cities on the Rhine, Speer, Worms, Mainz, very old and very honorable Mesora, and that's one way. But many Jews also moved farther to the east of that, in what we would call the eastern half of Germany, and they developed what they call Minhag Österreich, not Austria, but the Minhag of the eastern part of the German Empire, in which they modified their customs somewhat from the Yekis, which is why those of us who are not Yekis today do things a little bit different than the German Jews. Those Jews from the eastern part of the Reich are the ones who moved later into Poland. And that's the ancestors of the Ramon, people like him. That's the ancestors of them. And the result is that when you get to Ramon, you get those Minhagim. Minhagim of the Jews of the eastern part of the Reich, and the Kingdom of Poland, which is where he lived. And that eventually became the majority of the Ashkenaz. But there were some Yekis at that time who complained that his Minhagim that he records in the Shulchan Aruch and all that are not identical with theirs, and that he was prejudiced in favor of the eastern part of the Ashkenaz system. There's truth to that. A very famous and sharp attack was written against him by the brother Maral, for example, Chaim ben Bezalel. It's a, you know, these are nitty-gritty questions for the historians of halacha. Right now is not the time to go into that, because the Rama is much bigger than just that. Another part, though, in addition to being Mr. Halacha, because he was planning, actually, to write what you and I call the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, one big book to cover all the dinim. He's going to outdo the Rambam, outdo the Torah. But what happened was that while he was working on this, Rabbi Yosef Karo, far away in Israel, published the Shulchan Aruch. And so he found himself a little nonplussed, like, uh-oh. And what do I do now? I had an experience like that 30 years ago. Not that I'm, you know, on that level, but you're planning to write something and somebody beats you to it. And so what he did was he rearranged his material to say, okay, I'm going to add the Ashkenazic stuff, what you and I call the Ramote de Mapa, which means he took the existing book of Yosef Karo and just added to it. Originally, if it was on his own, he would have written, you know, the whole Shulchan Aruch from top to bottom. In fact, there is a story in the Magid Mesharim, I think, that the angel tells, I mean, I don't know if it's a true story, the angel tells Rabbi Yosef Karo in Israel, you better hurry up and finish this book, because the guy in Krakow, far away in Poland, and he's working to beat you, and, you know, if you don't hurry up, you know, you'll lose the race. So, these are the kind of rumors that popped up at that time. So, for those of you who don't know, Rabbi Yosef Karo in Israel wrote the Beis Yosef, which was his step A in writing the Grand Code of Jewish Law called the Shulchan Aruch. And the Beis Yosefs were scholars. So if you want to look up Gemara, I mean, you want to look up a halacha, you find it in such a place, and he'll give you the basic, the very basic way of getting the sources from the Gemara and the Rishonim forward. So you look in the Beis Yosef. And later on, he sort of summarized it in a separate book called the Shulchan Aruch. So the Ramah was planning to do the same thing like the Beis Yosef, but then the Beis Yosef beat him to it. So instead he wrote the Darkei Moshe, which is supplementing the Beis Yosef wrote with the Ashkenazi customs. And later on he did the same thing with the Shulchan Aruch. I hope I haven't confused you. Many of you probably know this. For those of you who don't, I'll just summarize by saying the Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote it first, and he put it the Sephardi way. And then the Ramah added to it the Ashkenazi way, to simplify. Okay? Now, this is one side of the Ramah. And like I said, I could talk for hours, so I have to limit myself. What's equal, I just want to bring up a few points today, that's all. Another side is the fact that he wasn't only interested in Gemara, 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 Halacha, 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 even though it's obviously what preoccupied his main time. As I said before, he lived in a rather cosmopolitan environment, and therefore, these Spanish Jews who moved to the court of the King of Poland and people like that brought in the Spanish traditions, especially the philosophical ones. Basically, I'm talking about the introduction into Ashkenaz, maybe for the first time, maybe not. That's the argument among big scholars of interest in philosophy. Ashkenazi Jews traditionally aren't into philosophy like the Rambam and those other people because the Ashkenaz Jews were not exposed to Arabic, philosophical trends. And therefore, the Ashkenazi communities, all the way back to Rashi's time, are usually identified with Gemara, 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 nothing else. That's almost like the Spitz from Ashkenaz, or what you and I called yeshivish today, super yeshivish. Gemara, 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 and a little bit of Halacha. That's it, that's it. But the Ramah lived at a time where Sephardim, running away from Spain, ended up in Poland. And they brought with them, I'm talking about from people, they brought with them not only the tradition of Sephardi learning, which is Chashuv, but also things besides Gemara, Gemara, Gemara. So I'll use the word Haskalah. Of course, I don't mean it in the modern sense. And particularly the philosophical writings of the Rambam, especially in the Mor Nevuchim. The Mor Nevuchim was printed for the first time when the Rambam was a young man. I think it was in 1551, I believe. If Rambam, so that means the Rambam was like 25, 26, 27 years old, something along those lines. And it made a big splash because the average guy in Yeshiva, Ashkenazi Yeshiva, knows the Rambam from the Rambam, you know, the Mishneh Torah. And here they come with, what is this philosophy business? And the Mor Nevuchim, the guy for the Plex, is pretty heavy. And especially when he starts speculating in this, speculating in that, and introduced those students who are interested to a whole new world of thinking. And the Ramah was a classic example, what I just said. Now, if you ever read what the Ramah writes about philosophy, it's clear he took no courses in it, so he wasn't really educated. He's an amateur, but he's very smart, obviously. And so he's speculating within the world of the Rambam. He clearly read through the Mor Nevuchim a bunch of times. And he eventually wrote a book sort of somewhat paralleling the Mor Nevuchim, although not exactly, and that's the Torah Sa'ola. This is probably the least read book of the Ramah, even though it's very big and very long, and it's recently reprinted the way I like it, with good letters and the kudos and everything. I was shocked to see that. And this is a grand explanation of the Ramah, of the symbolism of Kachim, the Beis HaMikdash architecture, the Mishkan architecture, the, what else? The Karbonos, the symbolism, everything. I'll just give you one example, because the Rambam pays some attention to this in the Murder, but not that much. What's the whole idea of sacrifice in Karbonos? Well, you kill an animal. That reminds us that the world itself and all reality is temporary, because after 6,000 years, the world will be destroyed. Even though the Rambam says that the world will not be destroyed, or he's not sure about it, but the Ramah says most of the Gemara and the others say that it will, and therefore what you see in the Karbonos is to remind you of this mortality. So the world itself is mortal, you understand? So it's interesting, what we call today, today we don't call it philosophy, we call it theosophy. But so what? There's a lot of unusual ideas in there, and he really, it's a very good sefer because he goes through every carbon you can think of. I'll tell you what I mean. I went through it once long ago. Not only do you do all the carbonos you find in the Chumash, any carbon you find in the Bible. If Abraham once sacrificed something on the way to Egypt, he discussed what it was and why he did it. If David HaMelech offered a certain carbon when he purchased the land of the future Beis HaMikdash from Aravna the Yavusi, he'll go into that. If one of the kings, like Shaul or whatever, offered a carbon in this place, he will go into that. It's a quite remarkable, his comprehensive nature. And he's always talking about, Kadmus Olam, the big invention of Judaism, the Chiddush is that the world comes from nothing, and the Karbonos are somehow always reinforcing this, and the furniture, the base that makes it, is reinforcing it. So to tell you the truth, for us in the 21st century, it's a little strange because it's written in a very Baroque style. It's a little boring. But if you persevere, it's like with a lot of Swarm, if you persevere, he has some very interesting ideas along there. So I'm just telling you, maybe we'll come out of this, if you listen to this podcast, maybe somebody will be moved, if you're that type, I'm serious now, that type to make a chavrusa with somebody and go through the Torah Sa'ola. You could do a lot worse. It's one of the classics, Swarm and Klal Yisrael, but probably one of the least read. But you see over there, he doesn't come across now as Mr. Halacha, Mr. Dry, Gemara, and all the rest of it. He's really looking for symbolism, metaphors, what's the meaning behind every little detail, the Karbonos, why do you have these Karbonos on Pesach, and those, you and I know Shavuos is around the corner. What's the with the Shtei Alechem, and why is it this way and that way? And he will also quote from all the other Rishonim, including the very rationalist ones. He quotes a lot from the Ralbach, from Gersonides, who's like a real left-winger. This is very interesting to me. I remember, for example, just off the top of my head, when he discusses the Ketores, say, what's the meaning of Ketores? Very symbolic, right? The Ketores. And, the whole thing is symbolic. And I remember he starts by saying, well, let's start from the bottom. The Ralbach said the Ketores is to prevent the stinking meat, because you're killing animals all over the Beis HaMikdash, so to provide, a perfume, deodorant for the Beis HaMikdash. That's a very rationalistic answer, But on the other hand, he moves up from there. You understand? And he's always quoting the Rambam and the Rambam. All I'm saying is it's not the Ramah that you would think of. So I'm just trying to acquaint you with this. And now that it came out in such a nice edition, maybe you'll be moved to read or take a look inside of it. The Ramah is also famous for, he's famous for many things, but I can only, talk about a few. One of the things he's famous for, I'll do it in this order, is, let's put it this way, being a very courageous posek. No, he calls it the way he sees it, and let the chips fall where they may. A classic case, a very interesting and very well-known case, is with the girl on the wedding on Friday afternoon. Here we come across an interesting phenomenon. I don't know if I discussed this or not. I can never remember if I repeat myself, tough luck. There used to be an old custom that you get married on Friday. I bet you many of you have heard that. But what's the reason? I don't think most people know why you used to get married Friday. And the answer goes like this. Weddings once upon a time, you're talking about the old world. In the old world, kids were married off by their families very young. 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, that sort of thing. In which case, it's an economic thing. You understand? The boy doesn't know the girl or vice versa. The family and the shadchan get together and they make the most economically advantageous match they can that they're able to secure. It's a certain mahalach. That's the old school. And they hoped that the marriage would last. There were successful marriages those days and unsuccessful ones. Just like nowadays, there are successful ones and unsuccessful ones. That was the old school. Problem then is that since the whole thing is financial, so you got two families. Let's say the boy's name is Yossi and the girl's name is Afegi, just for argument's sake. So, how would they do it? Yossi's 12 or 13 or 14, and so is Afegi. Fine. So now, they don't know anything about marriage, obviously. Well, the families will, when they get married, they'll live with one side or the other. How is this organized? Well, the Shadchanim have it all worked out that Yossi's family will kick in this amount, and Fagi's family will kick in that amount. They'll be put in some kind of escrow situation and invested in the way investments were done long, long ago. And as the couple grows up, they'll work it out that way, because it's all about money. Okay, now, if that's the case, this is a financial thing as much as anything else. Perhaps even more the most important factor. Okay, so a lot of times what happens like this. The general financial terms were put together by the Shadchan, who after all, as you know, is looking for his commission or her commission. So they're trying to gloss over any financial disagreements between the two sides. The two families would get together. They bring the boy and the girl to the chuppah, to that day. But then would come the hard bargaining. Or it could be, if it wasn't taken care of beforehand. Now, in a smart situation, they take care of all the hard bargaining beforehand. But a lot of times, the boy's family lives over here, the girl's family lives over there, they're far away. And so, to make a long story short, both families come together in the village of Shnibashik, and that's where the wedding's going to be, and his family's from this place, and her family's from that place, and they've got general arrangements, but they don't have the hard facts. So how many pillows are you giving? How many geese are you giving? How much money are you giving? Who's paying the schar dira and all that kind of business? Well, what happens in that kind of situation goes like this. Yossi's side is going to produce a negotiator representing Team Yossi. And that's going to be the biggest son of a gun in their family, the hardest bargainer and the toughest guy, Cousin Shmero. He's a real chaleria, a real, tough barger, Hungarian or something like that. And Fagi's side is going to do that. They got Cousin Shmero and Beryl, They got the toughest guy on their side. Okay, I don't have any problem with that. So here comes the boy and the girl. Again, they're both 13, they're both 14, they're both 15. So they're sort of like the minor actors in the drama. And now you have everything ready. Well, no, we don't have anything ready. Maybe it's ready, maybe it's not. But the actual tana'im, which in those days was taken seriously, has to be signed. And that will represent a genuine financial commitment. So where I'm going at is now begins a bargaining session. Shmerel represents Team A, Beryl represents Team B, and they go in the room and they start arguing. Well, in a good situation, after an hour, 2 hours, less, they'll come to some kind of, they'll hammer out an agreement, as we say today, and the wedding will proceed. But what if Beryl decides to play hardball, or Shmerel tries hardball? I'm talking about really hard bargaining. I know it's hard to believe, it doesn't happen in America, ha ha ha, but it happened in the old country. You could have a situation in which neither side will yield and the whole day will go by and the whole wedding will be for Bracha Levatol. Now you say, so what? You do it tomorrow. So a custom arose, which is you make the wedding on Friday. Why? Because then you got a deadline. Shabbos is 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. You gotta have the wedding before Shabbos. So that put a gun to the two sides. Yeah, Shmerel and Beryl are looking at the clock and they know they got to at least finish by 4 o'clock if they do the chuppah right away. Then they can have the meal and everything after Lichbenchen. But you see what I'm saying. And so having a wedding on Erev Shabbos put like a artificial time clock to hurry the negotiations. And usually that did the trick. However, my friends, there's a famous case in the Tshuvas HaRamah in which he says that there was a girl, it was an orphan girl, and therefore whoever was bargaining her side didn't have much power, because if she's an orphan girl, her side didn't have money. It was the boy's side. The bargaining went on and on and on. So basically, there were two real Jewish Jews. And make a long story short, it was up to Lichbenchen and neither side would give in to the other side. And so it was already Shabbos. It was already Lichbenchen time. They lit the candles. Oh my goodness. So what happened to the wedding? And, you know, and they didn't sign a tanoim, and they didn't come to any agreement. Or maybe they signed the tanoim, I forget the story exactly, maybe signed a tanoim right at Lech Benchen or something like that. It's too late to do the wedding. It's already Shabbos. What do you do? And the girl was an orphan, and it was unbelievable busha, and it's a good chance that, you know, since all this happened the wedding didn't take place, maybe the wedding will never take place. Maybe the boy's side will back out of it. And this was the girl and the poor Kala, you know, some little girl from a poor situation was crying. And Drama was involved. I don't, you know, he doesn't give you any details. This is a movie, right? What I'm telling you is a movie. It's a miniseries. And Drama said like this. He says, I'm doing the wedding Friday night. I'm doing it. Right? You're not supposed to make weddings on Friday night. That's what you think. And Echanami, it is true. But that's because the Mishnah says, Ein Mekachin, you know, you don't do weddings on Shabbos. But there is the opinion of the Rabbeinu Tam, which says that that only applies to people who don't have children yet, but somebody who hasn't proved, who don't want to have children, you can make the wedding even on Friday night. And we don't poskin that way usually, but I am doing it today. It's a classic case of a posek, in which it's a special situation. I know all the details, and I'm taking the responsibility on me. And I remember that Shubas Ramah, he said, the whole world is screaming hell, and they're down on my back, and they're all angry at me and all the rest of it, and I'm doing it anyway. And he wrote a whole Shubas to defend it. And not only that, this is the funny part. Not only that, he wrote a whole Shubas to defend it, he put it in the Shulchan Aruch. I kid you not. He wrote this. That's how sure he was that he was right. He's like sticking in everybody's face. I have in front of me a Shulchan Aruch. I usually don't do this. In Hilchos Shabbos, in Shin Lamed Tes, where he says, this is the Ramah talking. The Shulchan Aruch says, Lo Mekach, and you can't make a wedding on Shabbos. And now the Ramah takes over. Hagav, Yesh Matirin, Lekadish, Hechein, Isha Banan. But the Rabbeinu Tam says, you could make a wedding on Shabbos for a boy and a girl who don't have any children. And that's Kedushin, Epshah Hu Adin, L'chupa, Echnisa, L'chupa Shari. Not only Kedushin, but even the Suin. V'yafal Gav, this is all in the Shulchan Aruch. Even though usually we don't go that way. Nevertheless, if it's an emergency situation, I say you can do it. Think about the human dignity of the girl. Think about that. Then he says, this is strictly a theoretical, you know, this is in a law code. He's not going to say it happened to me. So he has to mask it and saying, like it happens sometimes. That the two sides bargained and like each one tried to chew the other down and play hardball until Shabbos was already made. So then we make the chuppah on Friday night. Because they already spent the money on the caterer. And it'll be unbelievable busha for the boy and the girl. That's being nice. The real busha was for the girl. He's just trying to be nice. Of course, you try to prevent such a situation from happening. And I've never heard of it in America, but that's a very interesting, typical Ramah. Very nice and very considerate, but his will was iron. And if he saw something, he saw that the girl is suffering or something like that, then he said, we're doing it. And he had big places, as the expression goes. For this reason, I can't say for this reason, but for here you have a funny situation, which is the Ramah developed, and nobody knows why, an unbelievable halachic charisma. What do I mean by halachic charisma? His opinions got accepted by all the Jews. And there are many people that disagreed with him, and there's grounds for agreeing and disagreeing. Reminds you a little bit of Moshe Feinstein in our time in America. You can argue on this, you can argue that. Some people have to see out there that the Olam says, if he said it, that's the way it goes. That's the did. And the classic example was his relationship with his cousin, I think, the Marshal, Shlomo Luria, was 10 years, 15 years older than him. It was a big rub, right? Marshal, you know, also the contemporary Ramah. And they have a lot of letters back to each other in the Shalos Teshuvos Ramah and the Shalos Teshuvos of Marshal, two big Gedolim. And the Marshal was formidable, of course. And you see, he's always criticizing the Ramah. But it doesn't matter. The Welt goes, as the expression goes, it goes like the Ramah and not like the Marshal. And there's a famous, these have entered into the Jewish history books, some of them, especially the one where they're arguing over something in Chulin. That's usually what it is, you know, little details in Chulin. and the Tinra and all that. And the Marshal is saying to him, you know, how do you know this? How do you know that? And the Ramah says, he was young. I say 15 years younger, at least. The Ramah says, well, I can bring this proof. I can bring this. I can also bring a proof from Aristotle. And the Marshal says, Aristotle, you bringing that guy? What's wrong with you? You're not from, and all this. And the Ramah says, I'm from, get off my back. I only read Aristotle in the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim. And second of all, I only do Mor Nevuchim and philosophy and all that. And believe me, it's a very tame and frum form of philosophy. I only do this on Shabbos afternoon or on Chol HaMoed or something like that, when everybody else is just walking around and taking a spatzir, like we would say today, you know, Bein HaShmoshes. And anyway, if the Aristotle's right, then he's right. You know, get off my back. And they had it back at each other. And it's really interesting because if you know who the Marshal was, he was a very honest person, but he had a big temper and he couldn't help. Some people are built this way. He's like the opposite of Ramah. If he sees something wrong or somebody does something wrong, he can't help but criticize the person. Doesn't mean bad. That's just who he is. These are people you don't like to be around. It's tough to be around them. And there's a lot of correspondence between the two of them. And the Ramah is always like the calm, cool one. And the Marshal is always like the hot and heavy one. And it's just very interesting because he respects him. He knew he was a great, each one knew the other one's a big gun. But you get these fights. Now here comes the sad story. Jewish history is full of this. You have two big Rabbanim or two big Rosh Yeshivas. Well, that means this guy's got Yeshiva A and the other guy's Yeshiva B. You're always going to have an element among the Yeshiva Bachim who love the fights. And they love to hawk, right? That's how it goes. They just hawk. And, you know, there's all Lashon Hara. My Shiva is bigger than your Shiva. And mine said this and insulted this. And yours said that and insulted that. And they cause a lot of trouble. A lot more than is necessary. And indeed, this happened a number of times. But very famously, well, it'll be famous in a minute. He says very prominently with the Ramon and the Marshal over the Mul Yisrael. What do they call that? My son says they call it roulades. You know, this is when you make meat within meat. These are things, these, again, you're a day of business. You understand? The kashrus and question of salting. And, you know, if you have, let's say you have chicken and inside the chicken you put beef and then put chicken inside, something like that. You know, I'm not a cook. But, you know, you got to salt the meat. And, but maybe you don't when it comes to roasting. There's a difference between bishul and non-bishul and tzli, and it's one thing to roast the outer meat, but what happens when you have meat within meat? So then if you do the salting of the outer meat, will that help for the inner meat, or what degree of salting do you have to do? I could explain it, but we're already over time. Let me put it this way. The Marshal had written something on this, or seemed to, and the Ramah, who wrote one of his books on Torah's Chatos, which is the technical nitty-gritty of Hilchos Kashrus in Yeridea. He wrote many Sfarim along those lines. So he said, very famously, he says, you know, you need to salt the meat properly, and even the inner one needs a salting, and it's not like certain person said. You know, that's the expression he goes. He said, not like a certain person expressed. Achadvorim hugadli, where'd it go? I wrote my opinion here, which was a machmer opinion in regard to this Mol Yisrael. To contradict what a certain Talmud Chacham said that I regard as being too lenient. Well, he never said who it was or anything like that, but the yeshiva guy, as soon as the sefer was published, they all examined it from one end to the other, looking for something to make a fight out of. Man, this is how it goes. And they said, who's the Chacham that he's contradicting or regarding his wrong? Must be our Rosh Yeshiva. And they immediately showed the Marshal. And the Marshal said, how do you know it's me? He said, oh, I know it's you. And even somebody wrote to the Ramah, just like like it's a little angel. He said, I just was wondering who you had in mind. Who was it? You know, in Kuflam at Beis. And Hashiveini Mar Laman Oshiv Chorpi Dover. I just want to know who you had in mind you were criticizing. And the Ramah answered back, what are you asking me questions like that for? How do you know who I had in mind? Well, by the time it's all over, again, it's a long story and the hour is late, It's very interesting, sir. Maybe I'll take this speech on the road. That's not a bad idea. Anyway, by the time you take it, they convinced the Marshal, they was referring to him. The Marshal had a meeting with the Ramos. They met him some chasen or something like that. He said, "Do you have me in mind?" And the Ramos said, "I didn't have you in mind. Anyway, I didn't say anybody's name. What do you care?" And Gova Turbinino, they got into a big fight. And shortly afterwards, the Ramos died. And the way the Marshal writes it sounds almost like a punishment. So you see over there a tragic story in which, let me put it this way. This is why the Chofetz Chaim wrote his book. This is why. Today were the day before Lag BaOmer. What is the Omer about? That the students of Rabbi Akiva all died because they're not knowing Chofetz Chaim is there. It's very interesting. The students caused trouble. The Rebbeim, the Rabbanim, the people of Rabbi Akiva didn't have a problem. But there's always going to be that element out there. You got to watch out for people like this. That they love to be talebearers, and after all, it's only for the Kabbalat Torah, and I'm thinking of my Rebbe and my yeshiva and all this, and next thing you know, some blowout, you know, some civil war breaks out, even among great people like this. I see I've gone over my time. Maybe some future time I'll tell you other things about the Rama, but he was a very, very interesting person. Sadly, he didn't live a long life, and there were others Farmi wrote, but How long can I go on these sorts of things? I'm trying to keep this short. So I'll end with that. I'll just say, it's a famous expression, that the Jewish people follow the Ramah, even though, as I said before, many people said, why follow this sheet or that sheet? There are many people that argue with them. Some people have that siyata d'shmaya. So here's someone who had a, I don't want to say a perfect life, but you know what I mean. He had much was given to him. He made much of the opportunity, and he achieved a halachic immortality, and that you can't say about a lot of people.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.